From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and our moderator, Shana Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome to the show. Here are the issues we will be covering. President Biden scores his first major legislative win as Congress passes a massive COVID relief bill with no support, though, from Republicans. We mark 1 year since the official start of the pandemic here in the U.S. We'll look back at what it was like in those early days, what we have been through this past year, and what we could be expecting in the coming months. Plus, the U.S. expands sanctions against the leader of the military coup in Myanmar as a deadly crackdown on protests continue in that country, and the U.S. Secretary of State warning more action could be coming. Richard, Kimberly, it's a pleasure to talk to both of you again. We really could use your analysis and wisdom tackling the big stories of the week, so I'm glad you're on the show. I want to start with the action taken by Congress passing a massive COVID relief bill. $1.9 trillion, that's the number to know. It's a very big number. In fact, this is the largest standalone stimulus package ever passed in American history, the largest. So, Kimberly, what's in it?
There's another round of direct stimulus or relief payments that will go out to most Americans, about $1,400, that will immediately give people some cash in the bank or in their pockets, depending on how they interact with the financial system. There's also expansions to tax credits for low-wage workers as well as families with children, and some of that money will actually be potentially coming even earlier than tax season when it usually arrives. There's more money for small businesses, a small expansion of the Paycheck Protection Program, but also new programs to help some of the worst hit segments of the economy, like entertainment venues and restaurants. A lot of money is going to be going, I think something like $350 billion, going to state and local governments to shore up their own programs, money to help reopen schools. This really is going to spread in a lot of different ways throughout the economy.
And yet, Richard, no Republicans, zero, supported this bill. Why not? What are their arguments?
Well, their main point fundamentally is that it's not a rescue or a relief plan. It's fundamentally a long list of old-fashioned left-wing priorities, according to them. They see this as a way to use money for Democratic priorities while there's still money from other plans that were voted last year that should be first used. There's this new interest in bringing down the deficit and bringing down the debt that wasn't there during the previous years, but suddenly they come up with this idea. There's also the impression that since we're seeing, even if it's not yet totally clear, fewer cases, more vaccination, restrictions are lifted, business are reopening, there's the impression that it could also overstimulate the economy with a risk of inflation. So there's definitely a ideological attitude on the Republican side, no vote on the Senate side, no vote on the House side, but the president wants to go ahead anyway.
A lot of good points you mentioned there. One of them being that this could do, like you said, overstimulate the economy, that the economy doesn't need a bill this large, and it could spark inflation, which would have its own economic repercussions. Kimberly, is the White House addressing any of these concerns, or is this sort of sell it to the American public that everything in this bill is good?
The White House is addressing it. The Federal Reserve is addressing it. And their response is basically, it's not that big of a deal. They say that inflation concerns are overblown. And even if there is inflation, we've heard from the Federal Reserve, our central bank, that they still believe that they have enough tools in their toolkit to be able to put a stop to inflation if it starts to get too crazy. But the Biden administration has consistently said that they are willing to accept the risk of overstimulating the economy if it means getting more of this cash out the door. And, you know, as Richard was just saying, advancing some of these priorities that they might not be able to pass on their own. One of the things of having such a closely divided Congress with the slimmest of majorities for the Democrats is that it makes it very hard to pass traditional legislation. So there was a big push to get as much of these Democratic priorities, especially the expensive ones, into this one piece of legislation. And I think we're going to be seeing similar moves with some of the other legislation coming down the pipeline.
The White House seems to be embracing this criticism that it's a liberal wish list. Like, yeah, exactly right. We want to expand the social safety net for this country, and that's precisely what we're trying to do. At this point, the bill is popular, according to polls. But that could change depending on how it's sort of implemented. If there's any corruption or misspending, or Americans don't get the money quick enough, or a big issue, if schools don't open fast enough, that positive sentiment can also change, Richard. So we are seeing the White House continue to try to sell this. What steps are they taking around that?
Well, it's just the beginning, Shayna. So the president is going to give his first primetime speech on Thursday. And in there, he's going to go over the year we've gone through. We're going to talk about it a little later. But with the pandemic, the sacrifices that were made, the people who were lost, he will also bring back, insist on what this American Rescue Plan will do to restart something that will look like a normal life. And then the traveling around the country. The White House has insisted on this. Starting on Tuesday in Pennsylvania, the president is going to sell his plan to the Americans. Joe Biden, when he was vice president of Barack Obama, the lesson is taken out of the way the Health Care Act, the Obamacare, was sold. It was not dynamic enough. Even also the rescue plans after the Great Recession, everything that the Obama administration did was too low key for him, and he doesn't want to make the same mistake this time. So we've been promised that not only the president, but the vice president, the first gentleman, the first lady, they will travel the country to tell the American how this is going to be helpful to them. And the fact that they also at the White House in Congress insist on the fact that it goes further than just checks being given all around the place, as Kimberly described so well, but it's fundamentally fighting poverty. Child poverty could be cut in half. And these are clear changes to the reality of Americans that could probably help stop people criticizing the details of this program. There was some fraud here or some excesses there. The fact that it will not only have an impact on Americans' health, but the American economy at large.
Right. And at the same time, Republicans will be selling or trying to sell to the American public why this is a disaster, that it's overly expensive, it's poorly targeted, it's bailing out blue states for mismanagement before the pandemic. So this is certainly going to be talking points that we're going to be hearing over and over from both sides. And speaking about both sides, I think both of you sort of mentioned that Biden and the Democrats really went at this alone. I mean, there was some attempt in the beginning, Kimberly, to bring Republicans on board, as we've been talking about, no Republican support for this. So what does that dynamic mean going forward for other pieces of legislation that Biden would like to pass?
I think it does a couple of things. First of all, it signals to Republicans that the Biden administration will go it alone. So if they want any part of some of these bigger legislative priorities, that they may have a stronger incentive to compromise. On the other hand, as we were just discussing, the power of rhetoric is very strong, especially leading up to the midterm elections. So a lot of Republicans may feel it's in their better interest just to say, no, we are going to continue to block all of these initiatives rather than get a compromise or some version of what we want. We feel it's better to just say no and stop them from advancing larger packages, because without any Republican support, the best they can do are these budget reconciliation bills. And those have a lot of restrictions I won't get into right now. But the point being is that saying no still limits the legislative agenda in some ways, but refusing to engage also means that what does get through will have very little Republican input moving forward.
Very good point. And yeah, I don't think we have enough time to do budget reconciliation and get in the weeds there, but that is the way this was passed, and that's why they were able to do it without Republican support. I just want to bring up a figure that I've been reading. This is now the sixth COVID relief package to pass in the past year. Between what Congress has approved and what the Fed has spent, it's more than $6 trillion that's been thrown at the struggling U.S. economy. That is more money than the cost of all of the post-9/11 wars combined on just one pandemic. I mean, Richard, when you hear that sort of how much money has been spent, I mean, it's pretty mind-boggling.
It is, and it's speechless. I mean, it's so interesting, Shannon, when you look at this, We just bring ourselves back before the Trump administration, when it seemed to be a real ideological divide between people favoring government investing in the economy and the other side more into controlling expenses, bringing down the deficits. Now it sounds on both sides, even if we're hearing more and more on the Republican side, the old conservative way of looking at managing public finances. But with the Trump administration, this idea of limiting expenses, no, the place of government in restarting, helping, organizing society is seen as far more fundamental and necessary than, I'm not talking about the 60s or the 50s now, just like 5 years ago. But I think the pandemic is this once in a century moment, event, reality that totally transform the way we want to organize the states. Trying to figure out how are we going to pay for this? You don't want to start thinking about this because it's almost unfathomable how you can organize society to end up paying for this. Thankfully, interest rates are so low that at the moment, it's probably the best time to borrow that amount of money.
Well said. Let's put this to rest, take a break. And when we come back, we'll cover immigration, 1 year since the pandemic began, and what's going on in Myanmar. We'll be right back.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace. Richard Luttendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and our moderator, Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome back to the show. We're going to be talking about an immigration crisis at the border right now, although the White House doesn't want to use that word. There is an issue going on. In recent weeks, there's been a surge in the number of migrant children trying to get into the U.S. According to the New York Times, the number of migrant children held in federal custody has tripled in recent weeks. The number of migrants trying to get in general are at levels we haven't seen in years. Kimberly, Biden has promised a more humane approach to immigration than his predecessor, Donald Trump. But how difficult is that balancing act given the complicated reality at the border?
This has been the struggle of many administrations, and it's not going to get any easier just because there's a new president in the White House. I mean, very famously, Obama began a large numbers of deportations and was roundly criticized for that. Then when Trump was in office, there were also policies that did indeed prevent people from crossing the border, the Remain in Mexico plans and things like that. And so by ending some of those policies, it did do what some activists say is release pent-up demand. And so this flood that we're seeing are people who were heavily restricted either because of pandemic regulations or through Trump-era policies that the Biden administration believes were deeply problematic, are now able to begin moving through the system. And that does create this surge. Additionally, the coronavirus pandemic is, hesitate to say this, but with the vaccine rollout and lowering hospitalizations, there are lessening fears of people coming into the country. So there's a lot of factors at play. There is not enough infrastructure at the border to handle all of these people, and that infrastructure was underinvested during the Trump administration as a disincentive for people to cross the border. So all of these things coming together are exactly as you said. It makes it a very complicated situation with real human consequences.
You brought up a lot of good points. I mean, the Biden administration has been saying this is a mess they inherited, and Biden has been pleading with immigrants not to come now. But regardless of whose fault it is, at this point, it's Biden's responsibility what happens at the border. And Republicans are really hammering the administration over this, blaming them for overturning Trump's immigration policies. And that's what's causing the surge. Richard, do you see Republicans making this a central issue in their attacks on Biden? And is it a winning issue?
Yes, for making it a central issue against the Biden administration. Yes, a winning issue with their electorate. Donald Trump had a lot of success in 2016 hammering these xenophobic policies. I did not see in the last election, general election, presidential and congressional election, a change within the Republican electorate on this issue. I'm afraid at the moment that the president is paying the price of his campaign, during which he insisted, and surely correctly, that his policy, his immigration policy, is going to be a more humane policy. Jen Psaki, his press secretary, repeats it almost every day. However, the message that was sent on the other side of the border is that, okay, now it's going to be easier to come in. Let's find a way to reach the border of the U.S. and Mexico. And so I'm afraid that even if on one side it was absolutely necessary to go back to something that looks more like American values, but the misery in Central America, the poverty, the violence, the reality of two hurricanes and the economic hardship that came out of there makes it so tempting to leave and to come north. At a certain point, not only technically, logistically, there won't be enough facilities and shelters for all these people, but just restarting this policy of, I'm using the expression of catch and release that is very often used. Unfortunately, I do believe it's going to be a winning argument for the Republicans during the midterms election.
You know, even though the White House is not calling this a crisis, clearly they do realize this is a big problem. You had White House officials down at the border visiting this week, and even if they're promising a more humane approach, when you've got that many kids being held in federal custody, unfortunately, a lot could go wrong. I want to move on to another big story this week. It's been a very important anniversary that a lot of Americans are marking. It's the one-year anniversary since this country started to go into the lockdown that we've been dealing with for the past year. Kim, I've been reading these recaps that news outlets have been putting out, sort of a day-by-day recap of this time last year. And as I'm reading it, as they're talking about how the country began shutting down, schools and businesses starting to close, my throat starts to close as well, because I know what's coming. It's not going to be a couple weeks. This is going to last a very long time. What are your thoughts when we look back at what happened this time last year?
I think back actually to February 26th. I know that March 11th was the day that the World Health Organization labeled this a pandemic, but on March 26th, there was a CDC doctor who gave a press conference and said that she sat down that morning at her breakfast table with her husband and her children and told them that their lives were about to change and that they needed to get ready and that it was going to upend everything. It was so prescient, and there were people who looked at what was going on back in March of last year, knew it was going to be bad, knew how bad it was going to be, knew what we could do to stop it. And one of the saddest things is that it didn't happen. I was on the show March of last year talking about some of those predictions and how bad it could be. And people knew what to do, but there was not the political will to do it. And so when I think about the more than 500,000 people that we've lost, and, you know, I was struck when we were talking earlier about the relief bill, how it's more money than we spent on all of these wars. We've lost more people than we lost in all of those wars. The unemployment situation is unprecedented since the Great Depression, and none of us will ever be the same. Our economy will not be the same. Our mental health situation in this country will never be the same when you think about the compounding effects of a year of grief and stress and parents working from home while trying to juggle the responsibilities of childcare and the fear, living under the cloud of fear for a year, is something that I think will change all of us forever.
And as you point out, different than the wars, we also have, as a country, not been really able to mourn the loss as you would, for instance, those who die in war. You could go to funerals, you can gather with loved ones to grieve together. Just the country has not been able to grieve together. 500,000 people, it's more than that now, just a staggering number. And Richard, I mean, it's been a tough year for everyone. I don't think anyone has really gotten through this year unscathed. The loss of life, the loss of financial security, millions of people getting sick, some still having side effects from being sick. Of course, this is not unique to the United States. This is a global pandemic. How are other countries marking a year into the pandemic? Although I know for some countries, this began earlier than here in the United States.
I think just the way Kimberly and you, Shana, described the reality in the U.S., how shocking it is, you know, 528 million people that we've lost because of this. They look at their own reality, and the fact that here in the US it's 10 million fewer jobs, jobs that have disappeared, people who are not working. And it's the same thing in those countries. I just want to underline this as for myself. Maybe I'm too much of an optimistic, but I'm looking at this, and just as you said, Shannon, you said it was tough for everyone. Well, the only good thing in this is that we were all in this together. The entire planet, we share that together. The sadness and the pain of having lost these people and our lives being transformed, we're starting more or less at the same point looking up at the moment.
And if I can continue the theme of seeing something good, there is some good news coming. I mean, the numbers of people being vaccinated in the U.S. every day, the numbers are at record highs. I mean, I think we've seen 2 million people being given vaccines a day. Public health experts are predicting that by the summer or by the fall, we'll have herd immunity. Kimberly, from just a political point of view, Biden had originally promised that we wouldn't see shots for everyone until the summer. Now he's saying we're going to see that much earlier in May. Do you think that's a deliberate strategy by the Biden administration to sort of under-promise and then over-deliver?
I think the risk of him being wrong and not delivering are so high that the benefit is only to under-promise and over-deliver. I think he made that original announcement before the Johnson & Johnson vaccine had been cleared and before those orders had been secured. And then once that supply came online, it opened the floodgates, you know, in terms of how many people could get vaccinated. I do think it's worthwhile thinking about vaccines, though, from the global perspective, which is that it's really great that the United States is getting all of the supply and all these folks are going to be able to be vaccinated. It will be very interesting to see how the vaccines flow throughout the rest of the world, including some of the less developed nations that don't have the ability to buy the vaccines in the more competitive marketplace. And so the thing that will really control the pandemic and these new variants will be getting this vaccine spread globally, and also back here in the United States, making sure that people actually want to take it because of a history of discrimination and bad relations with the medical establishment. A lot of the groups that are most vulnerable to the pandemic here in the U.S., talking about Black people and Hispanic and Latino people, are less likely to want to be vaccinated. And so there have been all of these big public service campaigns to try to convince people to be vaccinated, but that's going to be an ongoing challenge.
Yeah, the White House has been putting some effort into helping with that issue for sure. And this idea of vaccine diplomacy, as you've been talking about, on a sort of getting vaccines to other countries and some countries taking advantage of the influence they'll have getting vaccines to other countries is something we're going to be watching as well. Just very quickly, we have a couple of minutes left. I want to touch on a global story that continues to get a lot of attention. The U.S. this week expanded sanctions on the leader of the violent military coup in the Southeast Asian country of Myanmar or Burma. It's a country that for a time seemed to be heading towards democracy, but the military last month overthrew the democratically elected government. There's been a deadly crackdown on protests. Dozens of people have been killed. The U.S. is wading in. They have, as I said, they've imposed sanctions and threatening more action. Richard, my question is, why is this country so important to the U.S.?
I think we know that Myanmar in the region has a lot of influence. Myanmar moving towards democracy was inspiring on that side. And I think that the Americans are adopting a certain number of decisions to punish the military and the commander-in-chief, Min Aung Hlaing, and the people around him. But I think they do hope to work, they expect to work at the UN Security Council, at the UN at large, with China to, you know, transform the reality over there. And the simple fact that the ambassador at the UN, the Chinese ambassador at the UN, has called for a de-escalation is a sign that the Americans are not only going to work on sanctions against the military rulers, but are back also in the international sphere to use their allies and their partners to put pressure on the leaders over there.
Yeah, it's such a complicated issue. I mean, it's a strategically important country because it borders with China. China doesn't want to see a democracy in their backyard, but China also has a really uneasy relationship with the Myanmar military. I mean, they both support the military, but they also support rebel groups that fight the military. This is definitely a complex story, lots of moving pieces, and really sort of plays out this competition between the U.S. and China. We certainly don't have enough time to go into it, but thank you for your analysis on that. And that is all the time we have. Thanks to Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and Richard Lechendresse, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Shana Stulen. Thanks for listening.